Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of television pioneer Norman Lear. From his obituary on normanlear.com, Lear transformed American television with a groundbreaking series of shows in the 1970s that dominated ratings and generated national conversations by dealing openly with issues that challenged families and the country as a whole. Lear's more than 75-year career began in the 1950s and really took off in the 70s with All in the Family. This iconic show was followed by more hits like Sanford and Son, Maude, The Jeffersons, and many more. Check out the episode description to learn more about Norman Lear's activism and awards. For this episode, we are joined by pop culture historian Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong, whose best-selling books detail the stories and cultural impacts of television and film. Her latest book, So Fetch, The Making of Mean Girls and Why We're Still So Obsessed with It, was released in January, and Jennifer will visit the American Writers Museum on March 6th to chat about her book and the legacy of Mean Girls. It will also be live streamed, and you can register to attend on the American Writers Museum website. Jennifer is interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place on February 6th, 2024, and was recorded over Zoom.
Thank you for joining me today on the Nation of Writers podcast, Jennifer. I'm excited to chat with you about Norman Lear and his writing, producing, directing legacy. Before we get into that, can you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about yourself?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for having me. I am kind of a TV and comedy pop culture historian. I have written 8 books about pop culture history. My most recent is called So Fetch, which is a cultural history of the movie Mean Girls. And I've written other books like Seinfeldia, Sex and the City and Us. I wrote a book about the Mary Tyler Moore Show called Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted. But right now, yes, we are in So Fetch mode. And I will actually be joining the American Writers Museum for an event about that on March 6th.
That's right. Yeah. And we have a link in the description for you to access that and join us. It'll be a fun one for sure.
Yeah.
I know I'm excited about it. But first, let's get into Norman Lear a little bit. Can you tell me a little bit about your, first engagement with his work? How did you, come across his shows? I mean, they were everywhere, so it's kind of hard to not, but I'm just curious to your origin story, if you will.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm fairly certain that I was like a baby when I first probably encountered it, because it was the 70s and I was born in the 70s. So my guess is something like that I was, my family would watch these kinds of shows together from the very beginning of my life. What I really remember, though, and he's a huge part of kind of my origin story in television history, really getting interested in this stuff. I remember that I re-engaged with it somehow. My guess is I just stumbled upon some syndicated reruns of All in the Family in my teens. And I just sort of like lost my mind. It's one of the first times that I have an actual memory of like nerding out about something in television. Especially something that was historic at that time, right? That it was like, oh, this is an old thing that I'm finding out about now. And something that's very funny about it is that I immediately sort of recognized that Archie and Edith were, I used to joke that it was like, oh, they just put a microphone in my grandparents' house because they acted exactly like my grandparents. My grandfather was a lovable bigot, and my grandmother was very, she was a homemaker. She was very sort of like always fussing around the house, and they also fought all the time. I'd say they fought a little more than Archie and Edith, but that was fascinating to me. But then I just also like completely tripped out on like, I want to see every episode of this. I want to understand who made it. And that is one of the first times I remember really feeling that way about something on television and realizing that it was a special thing that deserved to be studied like art.
That's great. I love that.
Yeah.
Especially, yeah, because a great show just as far as a entertaining aspect. But I love that it also spurred you to, I mean, where you're at now in a way, a lifelong, pop culture historian, and that's great. And the when you mentioned like how it like it felt like you knew those people personally. That's what one thing I've appreciated in a lot of the research I've done and read about, and like the look backs on Norman's life, the realness that he those were real people. Whereas, as far as I understand in the sitcom world, especially in TV in general, that wasn't really the case yet, or it wasn't as real as he made it. Is that, would you say the same?
I mean, especially coming out of the 60s, that's something you really need to situate yourself in to appreciate him, I think, is the 60s were a real low point in terms of like television as art, right? In
Okay,
fact, nobody saw television as art before the 1970s. And I would say Norman Lear, as well as the Mary Tyler Moore Show and kind of its ilk afterwards. Those were kind of the two tracks where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we were like, oh, TV can be really good. The 60s, as tumultuous a political time as it was, people would be like watching, things burn on the news, watching the Vietnam War and protests and assassinations. And then, before that, the shows that were on right before they're between the news programs is like I Dream of Jeannie. You know what I mean? It's like you've got a female genie in a bottle who has appeared and cohabitates with an astronaut who, and she calls him master. Like that is the social re that is the extent of the social realism of the 60s, or Gilligan's Island, where people are just sort of like inexplicably marooned on an island and they're just a bunch of sort of stock characters and it's really dumb. TV was at its dumbest at that time. And then Norman Lear came along out of the 60s, right? And is like, no, we finally need to start reflecting what's happening in the world on our television. And that is the big bang of Norman Lear. I mean, it's a huge, huge change in now we're so used to it. It's like in the air and water. But at that time, it was absolutely like a bomb going off, especially his approach, as opposed to, say, the Mary Tyler Moore Show approach that was going on at the same time, which was equally revolutionary, but like not as loud. And kind of almost literally, I mean that. Like Norman's approach was really unique and I think special for the times, even that, like, I always saw it as he would sort of like drop an issue of the week into the Bunker's living room and let it explode. And that is why it is a very specific document of its times, but it was also extremely mind-blowing for people.
Yeah, that you make a great point of how now that's, yeah, that's it, of course, that's what TV does. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's interesting. And he was in TV for even 20 years prior to All in the Family, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's fairly normal. It's like, of course, he had to like kind of come up through it and get, he was writing comedy bits for the most part before that, which was very big business at the time.
Right.
Just like that was an extremely normal way to come up through television at that time. Now we just kind of have Saturday Night Live and then maybe some of the late night shows. But at that time, there were so many of these kind of like variety shows and things that people would come up kind of writing bits for, for these variety show type of productions and, Laugh-In and all of those kinds of things. And so he came up through comedy doing that. But it does feel like it's like if you look at the television landscape at the time, it's like this man sort of emerges, not out of nowhere, as we're saying, but it feels a little like that. Like, how did he just come out of, writing comedy bits, and all of a sudden he completely revolutionizes the form of television with his first big show.
Yeah, that is fascinating and impressive. And especially because from what I understand, it took a while for All in the Family for him to convince them to do it. And even I have the opening, the warning that was on for viewers, right? That it says, yeah, they needed to felt the need to put a warning that says, "The program you are about to see is All in the Family. It seeks to throw a humorous spotlight on our frailties, prejudices, and concerns. By making them a source of laughter, we hope to show, in a mature fashion, just how absurd they are.
That is a lot. Like that, like we would never. It's so crazy that that just shows you what I was just saying in a way,
Right.
how big a break from before this was, because like the fact that they have to they're basically explaining like satire and all of, I don't know, kind of all of everything, right? They're just explaining like it's not real.
Right.
Guys, it's not real. Like it was a very, it's actually just as a side note, it was a very big concern at the time. Like TV executives really did not, I don't think, respect viewers at all. So many of the discussions I've heard of, I did write a book about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which is why I keep bringing it up. But like, so it's my sort of like, way of orienting to the time as well. But there were so many discussions behind the scenes at this time that indicated to me that they really just thought audiences were incredibly dumb. Like another example from this time is that when the Mary Tyler Moore Show was coming on, its creators pitched the idea of Mary being divorced at first as the like concept for the show. And the executives said no because they were like worried that viewers would think that Mary had divorced Dick Van Dyke because the two of them had played husband and wife on the Dick Van Dyke show. And they worried it would be upsetting to people if the actress played a different character who was divorced, because they would think, I was like, what?
That's
Like, I just, it's so shocking when now, I mean, I would say if anything, like I don't want to say we take our, we assume too much intelligence in the audience, but like if you think about TV now, like it assumes a great deal of its audience, which I prefer. This is
right.
just a time when they acted like, I don't know, like people were just the dumbest. And so to me, that warning too is like, you guys, calm down. It's
Yeah.
not real.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting too, because it's like, yeah, the feeling like the viewership is, like you said, dumb, but and also at the same, a little bit of a like overinflated sense of their importance in the lives of
Good
people.
point.
Like,
Right. Like, this is really going to shock you.
yeah. Right. Yeah, but that and but that and the great part, which All in the Family proved it, due to its popularity, is that viewers A are smart and understand, get that that's a joke, and like you could connect it. They'd be like, oh, that is just like my grandfather or uncle or whatever, and it proved itself with the viewership. Like, it, you know, the dollars were coming in, and that, you know, networks, yeah, at that point realized, you know, the shift perhaps. And but yeah, but just the focus on reality, and you know, because at that time there's what, three networks basically, and so they have, you know, direct lines to regular people, and so then, you know, that's, I think, was his great, you know, shift, was focusing on the people who are the viewers as well, showing themselves on the
Right.
screen.
That's right. As opposed to this, as I was saying, like this, the 60s were extremely fantasy based. All of the shows, Bewitched, Green Acres. I mean, that's a little different. It's like, I guess Green Acres were recognizable people. I'm not sure. But it's like Beverly Hillbillies. They were all of these fantastical, whether they involved magic actually or not, a lot of them did. But even if they didn't, they were still pretty silly out there premises, these people from, these poor people from the South strike oil and move to Beverly Hills. That's not something where I wouldn't watch that and be like, it's just like my grandparents.
Right.
Like that's really what Norman brought to television in this incendiary way, was just these all of the, similarly, it's also about him, these older couple living with their daughter and her husband, who are young hippies, right? And that
Yeah.
too, this was all so relatable to people at that moment. And we hadn't seen anything like it reflected on television before that.
Right. Yeah. And it hit big.
It did. And I think
Impacted
that's
them.
why.
Exactly. Yeah. We've talked a little bit about the you know, kind of like cultural impact. I wonder if you want to get a little nerdy with the, like, you know, structure of episodes and sort of thing. What sort of writing shifts did he do in that as well, or if you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, I do think, the relatable characters are the beginning, and also this idea of the kind of issue of the week. In a way, this became this is like almost invents water cooler television. This is like, this makes you go talk to your friends and family and whatever the next day and be like, oh my God, did you see that they tackled this thing that we never thought anyone would talk about? They would just issue after issue after issue. Just like, this was, it was almost ripped from the headlines, whether it's the bunkers have a swastika painted on their door. Let's discuss that. A black family moves in and Archie is a known bigot. Let's see how that goes. It just, I remember there was an environmental episode. There were serious episodes at times. They would kind of blend into that at times and could do that more seamlessly because they were dealing with real life issues. It didn't feel strange. It didn't feel just, kind of that very special episode feeling. There's an episode where Edith is sexually assaulted. I have a very, this is so weird, but I have an extremely clear memory of there's an episode where Edith goes through, quote, the change. She has menopause. Like I just remember that somehow really made an impression on me, and I think because you didn't see it discussed in other places. So it was just this idea, and he brought this eventually to the other shows that became, this was like spin-off central for him at the Jeffersons, Maude, all of this stuff. They all took this with them, this penchant for bringing up issues that make sense for their characters to discuss, right? So Maude famously had an abortion episode, for instance. So they would, they would just sort of tackle all of these really taboo issues. And as I said, they would kind of just come up with a scenario to introduce this into the bunkers' lives. You do kind of, there's times when you're like, why does every single thing seem to happen to this family, right? But even something like the swastika, they kind of lampshade it by saying, like, oh, we might have been confused with a D Jewish family. So that's kind of their way of say of like bringing this into the bunker world and allowing them to discuss it while still trying to explain why it makes no sense that it would happen to them, right? But they would bring all of these issues into their lives, and I think it worked to some extent in that they lived in Queens, they lived in New York City, a metropolitan area, so they're going to encounter different kinds of people, for instance, and then they would just sort of allow. I think of it almost like a Socratic dialogue, right? It's like we have these four main, and it changed over time, but we'll just go with kind of that basic structure of like the four main characters, right? The younger couple and the older couple. And they kind of have different quadrants then of like what their perspectives are. And then they just sort of introduce this topic, gun controls, swastikas, black people, whatever. And then they kind of let them each have their perspective on it and fight about it. And that's really all the family is just introduce this. And I mean, we're going to talk about influences a little bit later, but you can see that this becomes extremely common. Even the fours are very common in TV history after this, from the Golden Girls to Sex and the City. Sex and the City uses this exact idea, except they introduce like sexual issues and have the four women debate it, right? So this is something that really is very effective. It's super simple and it allows the characters and the issues to kind of blossom before you or explode before you.
That's a great point. Yeah, and it's a testament to the character development. It's those characters, and then that, situation of the week or topic of the week is dropped on them, and then what do they do?
They all have, we know what Archie's going to have, sort of the bigoted, angry white man perspective. And it's always fun when then Edith jumps in. She doesn't always, but sometimes she'll surprise you and she'll jump in and like give, kind of give it back to Archie. And that's always exciting because he calls her dingbat. But we know she's not stupid. She just picks her battles. And then like Mike is obviously, he's the son-in-law and he's kind of the most verbose besides Archie. He is the classic kind of like hippie boomer At the time boomers were young.
Yeah.
At the time boomers were like saying Gen Z. He had kind of the hippie boomer youth vote there, right? And he'd be like, super liberal. And then his wife, who is their daughter, would also chime in often with kind of a feminist perspective. And so that is, there you go. You've got a bunch of, and then they would mix it up sometimes too. Once they bring in other characters like a George Jefferson or something, he might get in on the action and bring us a black man's perspective or that kind of thing. And that is really what's fun. And like you said, it's all about having the distinctive characters so that you're almost excited. Right, to see, like, the minute you hear, like, oh, we're going to talk about the swastika, then you start thinking, like, oh, what's Archie got? And you sort of have ideas, like, oh, Archie's going to think this and Mike's going to think that, and sometimes they'd surprise you, sometimes they wouldn't, but that's what was fun about watching it and allowed then I think people to take these issues into their own families or to their friends and have similar discussions. And I think that too is really interesting and also showed that at least in theory in the 70s on television, you could have discussions with people who had different perspectives from you and live through it and stay in the same house.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the end of the world to disagree necessarily,
Right. And
and
they would yell like a lot.
yeah.
But they showed us that it's okay, it's okay to have screaming fights with your family and then go on to the next day.
It's all in
All in the family.
the family. Yeah. You mentioned just now influences. That curious to hear more, both in terms of if you can see any, although I mean he was kind of at the beginning of TV, so there's not many like people that influence him perchance, but perhaps like yeah, but if there's any of that on the this before him that you can see that he yeah, but then of course like you just mentioned all the everything else like maybe we can pigeonhole it current on TV right now or streaming right now shows that you see are like directly influenced by Norman Lear's work.
I mean, you're right. He is at the beginning, and there's not a lot before him. I do think there's elements like it's he didn't totally come out of nowhere, even though it felt that way.
Yeah,
I think.
and also he was an avid radio listener as a kid too. So and that was the medium before so I just
Right.
so probably some of those storytellers as well on there.
I think so. I think so. Definitely. And I think even somebody like Carl Reiner, who he was friends with, who created the Dick Van Dyke Show, like that was one show that kind of started to have elements of like, yes, it was a lot like the family shows around it, but was kind of known for being a little more real, a little more genuinely funny, as opposed to cheesy funny than some of the others. There was a strand of this kind of starting to come up, this realism starting to come up through television before Norman even. There was a show called Room 222 that was about a teacher in a high school that did kind of try to tackle real issues that went on. It wasn't the explosive success that All in the Family was, so it kind of gets forgotten. But there were these, and even the Mary Tyler Moore Show came just a little bit before it. I think All in the Family was definitely in the works by then, but like that too was very interested in social realism. And I think they probably looked to things like, I don't know, a Lorraine Hansberry or something before them in terms of, I would say they probably looked more to movies or plays. For their influences, but there was this kind of cohort coming up through television that I think really thought it could be better and that it could use more elements of that social realism, especially given the times, the tumultuous times. And he was obviously, I think he sort of like burned the brightest and made the biggest impact, the loudest impact, but that this was something that people were interested in the years before that. And yeah, it's hard to say. It's hard to say who's influenced by him now because the answer is
I was
everybody.
gonna
I
say,
mean,
yeah.
literally, and especially I'd say the last 10 to 15 years, even more so, right? I think that it actually was still kind of an unusual idea say, in the early 2000s that television was supposed to tackle important issues. I don't think necessarily that we felt that. I felt that way. I remember feeling like an outlier that, like, no, it can do good. But then the last 10 to 15 years, it just became completely like everyone, like an assumption, like you said, that part, that at least part of what you're going to do is have good representation, right? That's one element, and that you're going to say something important and good with your, something pro-social with your work. I think in the early 2000s there was a little more of this kind of like pure comedy for comedy's sake, like a 30 Rock or something, which doesn't really, I'm sorry, like I guess we could say it's commenting on media and capitalism or something, but I'm not sure that was its mission.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like According to Jim as well,
Exactly. There you
like
go.
shows like
Exactly. Like,
that.
According to Jim, was not trying to say anything except that, like, schlubby guys should have super hot wives. That was its main mission. But I think as we got into the streaming era, and which coincides with a with the Great Awakening, right? I think that's where you start to get into, like, of course, TV is supposed to, it's supposed to do both, is what we think. And I think that I believe that it's supposed to be great and it's supposed to say something, and especially comedy, like comedy in particular. Obviously, drama, we've always felt, it always had that sense of importance. Whereas comedy is the part that Lear really pioneered, and then we dropped for a lot, right? The 80s were just devoid. All of a sudden it was just like Facts of Life and Silver Spoons. So we did kind of drop that for a long time. But you had, I would say Golden Girls, Murphy Brown, Designing Women, those have that feeling. I do think, I would argue that Sex and the City did it, specifically for, single professional women. That was a big moment, and I do think it's weirdly Learian, even though I'm not sure if everybody thought of it that way. But then you really, now you get into any, Black-ish.
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah, those,
I know that, like, they've talked about that they were super influenced by him. I think of something like Abbott Elementary now, which is incredibly funny, but also is just like, sometimes we do, just plot lines about charter schools, and they're hilarious, So those are the more obvious ones. But I think even, it's like everybody to some extent, but even something like Insecure, Issa Rae, any of these, it's like most shows at this point, I think, are expected. I don't know that necessarily they make you tell them this when you pitch a show, but I think it has to sort of be there that, like, who wants a show at this point that doesn't do anything? Even Abbott Elementary, which has been widely credited for kind of bringing back the traditional network sitcom, is very Learian, And I would say something like Parks and Rec, all of these, it's like most of our comedies at this point. Ted Lasso, I think in a different, if in the 80s, that same pitch line, like, fish out of water, goofy American coach goes to London to, to coach a soccer team, would have looked very different from it looked in the 2020s, which is that it turned out to be about an
Mental
important
health.
lesson in toxic masculinity. Not what we would have done in the 80s, but it's very Learian to give him this, backstory about his own father, and to have him teaching important lessons about masculinity to the young men in his care is a very different deal, And it might not necessarily be like issue of the week type stuff, but it still is that idea that, like, it's that comedy can teach and heal and all of these things and do good.
And there's I wrote it down somewhere, but I can't, but as a quote I came across from Lear's that was, something along the lines of, I set out to do comedy, and then I found that the more you give the viewer to care about, the more they care, the more they'll laugh as well, which is like, I like that quote. That's why I wrote, obviously wrote down, I can't find it, but yeah, just the the truth in the jokes is really what people latch on to, and I keep saying the word real. The realness of the jokes is makes them funnier because they're related more relatable, and those are the kind of jokes that stick with you because they make you think as well.
Right. And they, when people then can go out and talk, like we've been talking about, like they can take that and go talk to their friends and say, like, oh my God, did you see this line? It was so funny or whatever. But that allows you to kind of start having a conversation from this different place rather than going up to your friends and being like, what do you think about gun control? Like instead, I mean, I'm harping on Abbott Elementary right now, but I do think it's so close. And a great example of a similar effect that it had on me recently is that, like, I don't have kids, so I've just like had the privilege of just not teaching myself about charter schools. And I finally, because of their plot line on there, I was like, all right, I gotta just figure this out already. And I like listened to some podcasts and all of this. I understood like the basics, but I really wanted to understand what was happening and understand kind of like what was going on beneath the rhetoric. And this finally inspired me to do that. So that's like a great example of where, and it was a really, it doesn't stop being funny. And that's the thing that I think Lear taught people is that you don't have to stop being funny. And also, something that we probably don't do as much now as he did, which is just like really go there on certain issues, like say some, like allow some of your characters. I think we do that less now. I'm not saying, that's a whole other debate that like could take an hour of like, should you have a lovable bigot and should you allow him to say the things that we don't say? And I think there's less of an appetite for that now because it scares people so much. But that is something that he did a lot as well. And is something that we continue to debate, I think, with our comedians, with our comedy in general. Like, should comedy do that? Archie was, famously this lovable bigot that a lot of people saw as a hero, when in fact that was not Lear's intention for him at all. And if you look at what happens to Archie and things, it's very clear where Lear comes down, right? Archie is continuously undermined, is what I would say, and taught lessons. But a lot of people just looked at that man as just like, yeah, he's finally telling it like it is. And that was always a problem. And I know Lear talked about that as a problem. I mean, I think we had a president who is about to run for president again, who has essentially made himself into the Archie Bunker image for good or ill. We don't need to get too far into that, but I truly believe if the ultimate influence is that that Donald Trump has taken some of Archie Bunker's tricks and turned them into, kind of twisted them around in this completely unexpected direction. But I think all of this is very, it's all fodder for debate.
Yeah, I feel you. It makes me think of Lear's sort of post-TV life and career was very heavily involved in activism, specifically, from what I understand, to to try to like put it in the gist of it, is First Amendment issues, freedom to speak and believe in whatever religion you want, because he was I you know Norman Lear was Jewish, and he dropped out of college to fight in World War II, and then because he cared and realized the moment and what needed to be done, and but then also the years later, Jerry Falwell,
Yes.
Lear was absolutely afraid and like rightfully so about the co combination of church and state, and saying that you're a good or bad Jew or good or bad Christian or whatever is like that's not the American way. And so then he founds the People for the American Way, and then even years later buys a copy of the Declaration of Independence and trots that around to schools,
That's right.
gets thousands of young voters to register to vote ahead of the 2008 presidential election, which again, it's just a continuation of what he was, to me at least, it seems a continuation of what he was trying to get across to the American people in his TV shows.
Yeah, exactly. I love this about him because it really, you don't see a ton of it. And I mean, I'm sure there's good reasons for a lot of this, but you know, in terms of like a lot of other people would, you know, have made liberal progressive programming, but not necessarily, you know, walked the walk. And this man really seems to have been, I mean, I'm not sure, but it looks almost like he was sort of radicalized by his experience making television in the 1970s specifically. And the Christian right was coming up then. So I think that that has a lot to do with it. And in fact, the Christian right was sort of starting to try to influence television in the late 70s. That's how we got things like the Family Hour. I don't know if people remember that or are aware of that, but like TV was sort of like forced to say like, oh, we're going to have a quote Family Hour at the beginning of prime time that will be safer for families to watch television. But that was a self-policing effort, you know, to try to sort of stave this off, was to say like, look, we'll do this if you leave us alone. But Lear and the Mary Tyler Moore Show people and a number of others at the time felt as if a huge part of this incursion was simply the content, not like, oh, it's sexy and violent, but that like they were getting super progressive on these shows and that the Christian right did not like this. So I think this must have been a really sparking moment for him because he did spend essentially the rest of his life doing several, you know, with a lot of activism, but particularly worried about the rise of the Christian right. And I would argue that he was correct, that he saw this sort of coming and it's continuing to this day, right? He died at 101 and his work wasn't done. It was only maybe just beginning in terms of this. And I love seeing that he continued to kind of not just do his work, but also have this real activism, to actually do things in the world. And I know he also has foundations and groups that work specifically with using comedy to change the world, essentially. So I love that he had all these different things going on. And it wasn't just, oh, I'm going to make television and it happens to be progressive because I am. He was like, no, I am doing this, you know, correctly, and continued to be active on both fronts throughout the rest of his life, which is super cool to me.
I agree. Yeah. In the research I did, and I watched the PBS American Masters episode about him, which is great as well. But just all the moments in which he fought with the censors and the networks. And there was another quote I wrote down. It was in that American Masters PBS episode, and he's talking about fighting with the censors. And this one it was specifically about the abortion episode of Maud, and how, that he kept, fighting for it. So he knew it mattered, and he knew that real people were dealing with the same dilemma on a daily basis in America. And even though people weren't talking about it at the time necessarily, but people were living it. And he's talking about fighting with the censors, and the networks would usually take the position of something along the lines of, I don't know why these writers are doing this. They're biting the hands that feed them. But then the quote that is like Norman says, I consider that the creative community are the hands that feed, and they are biting our hands. And
Great.
that, yeah, and that's, and then like you were just saying, he kept that going on his whole career and post career. I mean, he never really stopped entertaining, which is also the great thing about him. But yeah, he kept that the freedom to create and express is the ultimate end for him, it seems. And to do so with respect to everyone.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's so American, kind of like what he does. Because specifically, he seems very like he more than maybe anyone I can think of, especially in television, can see the connection between something very populist like television and democracy. Right? To me, that's what he's like, just hearing him say that and thinking about these issues, what he's doing is introducing these important issues to the American public through his programming and saying, like, you need to think about this because you need to vote. And it's all connect, right? You need to understand these issues because this is your job too. And I need to be able to discuss things like abortion in my work. And I mean, the abortion one in particular is just, you know, think of the, you can probably still, all of us can probably still name like a handful of times we've seen abortion discussed in television. And because it's so like more than all these other things, I feel like it has always been so contentious in terms of like, I've heard many stories of TV executives being like, can you just not, why do we have to do this to us? Can she just lose the baby? Can she, like just have a miscarriage? Like, it there was often this discussion, and it was it for especially it was like Maud had her abortion, and then there's like decades go by before anyone touches this thing again until like the 2000s. And it still is super, super sort of like weird and touchy and contentious. And I would say we didn't start getting super real about it until the streaming era, And that's when, you don't necessarily have advertisers who have a say in. That's why a lot of things change in the streaming eras, because you don't have advertisers who are going to boycott if if you do certain issues. And so he was dealing in a situation where that was the main concern at all times, is that at any time people could get upset and you could lose advertisers. And so it was a very, it was a hard time to do this, and he did it anyway.
Because he knew, he knew it needed to be done, and he knew it would work too. And just another quote I wrote down real quick with about that episode, that Maude episode, that Norman said was because he, he got a lot of mail and letters and death threats, and he said that episode of Maude got 17,000 letters and 65 million viewers, and there wasn't a single state that seceded from the union. Which is just so
Those
quintessentially.
viewership numbers at that time are shocking. So many people watched these television
He
shows.
had, and then at one point he had what, like three out of the top five shows on television he was running, you know?
That is just it's hard to explain to people like the gravity of shows then, where now it's like if you get, I don't know, a million or a couple million, it's like a huge hit. At that time, it was just like three networks and you were gonna choose one. And so it was like everyone, like most people had the TV on at night. And so they would just choose a network and to have it on. And this was just astronomically huge. And so it just was a very different thing. It's hard. I can't even think of an equivalent to like say, here's what it would be like. It's like the Super Bowl, but every week, in terms of just like the cultural impact and the number of people paying attention to it is just shocking, all until we get into the cable and streaming era. It's which is an entirely different thing.
It was almost like the Super Bowl multiple times a week.
It's so crazy. It's so just when you said that number, I was like, oh, right. So many people watch TV then. Just watch a network television show, and so it just changes the calculus of all of this. So it's a lot harder to be doing this stuff when that when tens and tens of millions of people are watching your show. It's going to be a lot of different kinds of people just by math, versus now where like people choose their one little tiny, it's like such a niche little thing. It's going to be a bunch of people who are very similar watching this one show on HBO or whatever. It's just not the same at all. And if you think of something like Succession or Game of Thrones, even that felt big now, it's like a tiny, tiny fraction of what was going on with a show like this then.
Because they're like you said, if you wanted entertainment, you wanted to have the TV on after work when you're at home, there was not much to choose from necessarily. And especially not much to choose from that you didn't have to pay for, like the big three were and still are, just around, available,
Right. It was just, and it was so much more about like this was part of this one famous TV lineup, All in the Family was, that they put it on Saturdays, and they thought like at first our people are going to watch this, and people started staying home on Saturday nights to specifically watch this lineup, because it was like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, All in the Family, the Bob Newhart Show, the Carol Burnett Show. Like it was just like the great, like it truly is like all of these incredible shows. And that was always the dream at that time, right? Because you have to remember, I mean, this is also like way back, but there were still dials on your TV and also not a lot of remotes. So if you could get people to just put the channel on, it'd be very unlikely for them to change it. So the whole goal was to get like a bunch of shows together that people wouldn't change the channel and just leave it on from like 7 p.m. until through the news. And that was like your goal. And that's why I mean, I'm totally going in the weeds here, but things like the Today Show were huge because it was like, if you could get them to put that channel on in the morning, they might not change
Yeah.
it. And so it was just this whole, it's just a very different time in television. And this, his shows were such a force in that, in getting people, like they were seen as the glue that would get people, you know, to put that channel on and stay there because they recognize, oh, this is a Norman Lear show. I love these characters. I love what he does. This is what I'm going to watch.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the difference between the eras, which it also incredibly impressive that Norman Lear seen not only seen but worked in every era of TV.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, you know, he just, you know, just passed away a couple months ago in December. But yeah, so he saw the from the beginning that we were talking about in the early 50s to now, and
Radio even like
radio, yeah.
he was a radio listener and I cannot will never I don't know if anyone is ever going to have the same kind of like trajectory in terms of just what he saw in technological advancement. I do think that's mind-blowing that he started out as like a radio fan and he ends up in an era when he can probably see any one of his shows
Yeah.
at the touch of a button. On a streaming service, and that like kids can just suddenly pick up All in the Family. I, you know, that's something that none of them foresaw. They didn't think,
Right.
oh, somebody's still going to be watching Archie Bunker in 2024. They just were making a show that like kind of went away. Like you
Yeah.
didn't have VCRs at the time. So the idea was like you watched it that week and it was gone forever until they
Right.
showed it in rerun. Whereas like, so they just didn't have that sense that like, oh, this is literally gonna last forever, you
But
know.
yeah, a historical document,
Right. They had no
almost.
idea, but it is now. And I think that that's another thing that's really special about that show in particular, but I would say any of his shows, that they are a real document of that specific time frame, like what people were talking about at that time and how they talked about it.
And now, since we mentioned streaming a little bit, I want to take a little bit of Dead Rider drama. This is a crossover episode. If you did, listeners, if you didn't know, Jennifer is the co-host of Dead Rider Drama, one of our other podcasts. And so I want to do a little bit of a lightning round here, if I can remember. And this one's interesting though, because he was
He did
around for the
live
current time,
now.
and like, and was still, even at 100 plus years old, filming videos to put on social media and things to, yeah, there's unreal.
It really is nuts.
So I was going to ask in the social media question from Dead Rider Drama, Instagram or Twitter or LinkedIn or Facebook. But the thing is, we already know the we already
Yeah,
know those answers because he
it's
was
true.
doing them.
It's true. Yeah.
But I do, since he is a TV writer, the other lightning round question I want to ask from Dead Rider Drama is, if there were a series about him, or a biopic, or what would be the preferred medium? Like, and I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember the ones. It's like a HBO miniseries, a biopic. What would be his preferred medium to tell his story
I
on
think I'm going to say as a limited series. I
limited
think a
series?
limited series because his life was so long. And but you would also want, you know, you don't want to go too long. You don't want to just like go on forever and ever and ever. I think he would agree with that. But I do think you could get like different eras of his life. I want, you know, like Taylor Swift, he had eras and I think it'd be fun to see some of the different parts of his life, you know, coming up with All in the Family and like just you mentioned this, but like, you know, it seems as if the just the pitching process and the getting that thing on the air took quite some time and a lot of work. And kind of that like even him coming up through the 60s, I think would be really interesting, writing comedy and then having his own show that takes over the world. starting his political activism all the way through to being in his 90s and so active. Like you said, I mean, he was totally like go walking around, filming videos, like doing interviews until the very end. And it was oddly shocking when he died. Even though he was 101, we were all just, oh, I
No, I
guess
remember.
that was gonna happen, but
Yeah,
it
I
was
remember
still,
that. Yeah, it was weird. It was like,
yeah.
oh, wow.
Oh, right. I mean, it had to happen. It was like Betty White, but it was like, oh, this ha we
Yeah.
knew it, it like that we knew humans don't last forever, but it was still a little bit of a jarring because it's also just living in a post Norman Lear world. But he was, you know, he had several shows in development when he died, at 101.
Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, I think, and also I think especially the era in which he kind of sees the world, as we said, embrace his values th across television, as opposed to like he was sort of a brand, right, in television, but then now it's like it's everywhere. And I think that's part of why he had all of these shows in development. He had that really lovely, the only good reboot possibly ever made, One Day at a Time. And I think there were a number of his other shows kind of in discussion for the revival, you know, kind of treatment. And I think that made sense in his case
Yeah.
because we now live in Norman Lear's world and the world finally caught up to him. So it actually makes total sense to revisit his shows.
Yeah, do you think they'll continue those that
I
the
hope
reboot
so. I don't
process or
know. I don't know, but I think it's an interesting, I think you could do any of them and it would be sort of interesting. Right? Imagine and I never say I want to reboot, by the way. I am like so anti-reboot in most cases. But like,
Agreed.
isn't All in the Family kind of interesting now? You know, like across generational and cross political discussion like that right now would be really interesting. I did read that his not super popular 70s show, but cult favorite, Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, was in development for a possible reboot. And I think that'd be very interesting because it wasn't a huge success the first time, but might be an interesting thing to do now. I think he was a little maybe ahead of his time, slash, he invented our time. So, you know, I think it's one of the few cases in which I think it makes some sense that he, you know, that we're revisiting work like his.
Yeah. I love how you said, yeah, we finally caught up to him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
Yeah.
as we're getting close to the end here, was there anything that we haven't touched on that you wanted to chat about?
I don't think so. I think it's just so he's such a, I mean, I really cannot think of anyone who is more influential on television. Period. End of story. And I also don't say that lightly. You know, it's strange because All in the Family was sort of his masterpiece and it was his first thing. You don't see that every day. everything that he did afterwards was in that mold. And everything that everyone else did afterwards, I think was a response. I think that's so fascinating that like to have that big a show. That essentially every show that comes after has to be a response creatively or something to, you know, even Charlie's Angels is a response to that. It's saying, nope, we're going to do the opposite, right? But it still was. It's like you couldn't work in the 70s or actually any time after that without kind of like crafting your work as like, is this like Lear or is this not like Lear? And you can see it through all kinds of crazy, as we've talked about. I think you can see it through things that you don't even think, like a Seinfeld or a Sex and the City still has, you know, little glimmers of Norman Lear back there behind all of the other bells and whistles. So just an absolute monster talent and, you know, influence in television.
Yeah, absolutely. There in the PBS episode, someone said there's TV is can be marked by BN and AN
Absolutely
before
true.
Norman and after Norman.
It's
Yeah.
really, really true that there's just, I mean, it, like I said, and I don't say it lightly, but he is the icon, I think, of in terms of TV creators and showrunners.
Agreed. Yeah. Well, thank you, Jennifer, for spending this time with me. I wanted to end with one more the final quote that I wrote down from that PBS documentary. It was towards the very end of it, and he was talking, people ask him, how are you, what's the key to long life, how do you, and he's like some things add years, like working out or eating well. He's like, but my God, does laughter add years?
That's really lovely. I love that.
Thanks again, Jennifer, and listeners, on March 6th at 6 p.m. It is a Wednesday, so you should wear pink. Jennifer will be at the American Writers Museum talking about So Fetch, The Making of Mean Girls, and why we're still so obsessed with it. It'll also be streamed online if you're not in Chicago. But again, there's links to all of that in the episode description and on the AmericanWritersMuseum.org. So yeah, I just want to thank you again, Jennifer, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in March.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.